not doing deliberate practice. This is how experts practice. First, they set a stretch goal, zeroing in on just one narrow aspect of their overall performance. Rather than focus on what they already do well, experts strive to improve specific weaknesses. They intentionally seek out challenges they can't yet meet. Olympic gold medal swimmer Rowdy Gaines, for example, said, "At every practice, I would try to beat myself. If my coach gave me 10 100s one day and asked me to hold 115, then the next day, when he gave me 10 100s, I'd try to hold 114. This means swimming 100 meters in 1 minute and 15 seconds, and then trying to do the same in 1 minute and 14 seconds, and so on. Virtuoso violist Roberto Diaz describes working to find your Achilles heel, the specific aspect of the music that needs problem solving. Then, with undivided attention and great effort, experts strive to reach their stretch goal. Interestingly, many choose to do so while nobody's watching. Basketball great Kevin Durant has said, "I probably spend 70% of my time by myself, working on my game, just trying to fine-tune every single piece of my game." Likewise, the amount of time musicians devote to practicing alone is a much better predictor of how quickly they develop than time spent practicing with other musicians. As soon as possible, experts hungrily seek feedback on how they did. Necessarily, much of that feedback is negative. This means that experts are more interested in what they did wrong, so they can fix it, than what they did right. The active processing of this feedback is as essential as its immediacy. Here's how Ulrich Christensen learned this lesson. Christensen is a physician-turned-entrepreneur whose adaptive learning software is designed around the principles of deliberate practice. One of his early projects was a virtual reality game that teaches doctors the proper handling of urgent, complex cardiac conditions such as strokes and heart attacks. During one training session, he found himself alone with a physician who seemed unable to finish. "I couldn't figure it out," Christensen told me. "This guy wasn't stupid, but after hours of detailed feedback on what he'd done wrong, he still wasn't getting the right answers. Everyone else had gone home, and there we were, stuck." Exasperated, Christensen stopped him just before he got the next round of feedback. "Time out," Christensen said. "What you just did, treating this patient, is there anything you did just now where you were in doubt? Anything where you weren't sure it met the new guidelines?" The doctor thought a moment, and then listed decisions he'd been certain about. Then he named a few choices about which he was less sure. In other words, he reflected for a moment on what he knew and what he didn't. Christensen nodded, listening. And when the doctor was finished, he let him see the computer screen with the same feedback that had been displayed a dozen times before. On the next trial, the doctor executed the procedure correctly. And after feedback, then what? Then experts do it all over again, and again, and again, until they have finally mastered what they set out to do, until what was a struggle before is now fluent and flawless. Until conscious incompetence becomes unconscious competence. In the story of the doctor who finally took a moment to think about what he was doing, Christensen kept the practice going until the doctor was doing the procedure without any errors at all. After four consecutive, perfectly correct repetitions, Christensen said, "Good job, we're done with this for the day." And then what? What follows mastery of a stretch goal? Then, experts start all over again with a new stretch goal. One by one, these subtle refinements add up to dazzling mastery. Deliberate practice was first studied in chess players and then in musicians and athletes. If you're not a chess player, musician, or athlete, you might be wondering whether the general principles of deliberate practice apply to you. Without hesitation, I can tell you the answer. Yes. Even the most complex and creative of human abilities can be broken down into component skills, each of which can be practiced, practiced, practiced. For example, deliberate practice is how Benjamin Franklin described improving his writing. In his autobiography, Franklin describes collecting the very best essays in his favorite magazine, The Spectator. He read and reread them, taking notes, and then he hid the originals in a drawer. Next, Franklin rewrote the essays. Then, he writes, I compared my Spectator with the original, discovered some of my faults, and corrected them. Like the modern-day experts Erickson studies, Franklin zeroed in on specific weaknesses and drilled them relentlessly. For instance, to improve his ability to make logical arguments, Franklin would jumble his notes on essays and then attempt to put them in a sensible order. This was to teach me method in the arrangement of the thoughts, he later observed. Likewise, to enhance his command of language, Franklin practiced, over and over again, the translation of prose into poetry and poetry into prose. Franklin's witty aphorisms make it hard to believe he wasn't a natural writer from the very start. But perhaps we should let Franklin himself have the last word on the matter. There are no gains without pains. But what if you're not a writer either? If you're in business, listen to what management guru Peter Drucker said after a lifetime of advising CEOs. Effective management, quote, demands doing certain and fairly simple things. It consists of a small number of practices, unquote. If you're a surgeon, consider what Atul Gawande has said. People often assume that you have to have great hands to become a surgeon, but it's not true. What's most important, Gawande said, is practicing this one difficult thing day and night for years on end. If you want to break a world record, as magician David Blaine did when he held his breath underwater for 17 minutes, watch his TED Talk. At the very end, the man who can control every aspect of his physiology breaks down sobbing. As a magician, I try to show things to people that seem impossible. And I think magic, whether I'm holding my breath or shuffling a deck of cards, is pretty simple. It's practice. It's training. And it's, then he sobs, experimenting. And he sobs again. While pushing through the pain to be the best that I can be. And that's what magic is to me. After getting to know each other a little better, Erickson and I designed a study to discover how exactly gritty kids triumph at the National Spelling Bee. I already knew that grittier spellers accumulated more practice and performed better than their less gritty competitors. What I didn't know was whether deliberate practice was driving these skill improvements, and whether it was grit that enabled spellers to do more of it. With the help of Erickson's students, we began by interviewing Spelling Bee finalists to learn what sorts of things they did to prepare for competition. In parallel, we pored through published books on the topic, including How to Spell Like a Champ by the Bee's own national director, Paige Kimball. We learned that there are basically three types of activities recommended by experienced spellers, their parents, and coaches. First, reading for pleasure and playing word games like Scrabble. Second, getting quizzed by another person or a computer program. Third, unassisted and solitary spelling practice, including memorizing new words from the dictionary, reviewing words in a spelling notebook, and committing to memory Latin, Greek, and other word origins. Only this third category of activity met the criteria for deliberate practice. Several months before the final competition, spellers were mailed questionnaires. In addition to the grit scale, we asked them to complete a log in which they estimated the hours per week they spent on various spelling activities. We also asked them to rate how it felt to do these activities, in terms of enjoyment and effort, in the moment they were doing them. That May, When the finals aired on ESPN, Anders Ericsson and I were watching. Who took home the trophy? A 13-year-old girl named Carrie Close. It was her fifth consecutive year of competition, and from the log she completed in our study, I estimate she'd accumulated at least 3,000 hours of spelling practice. Carrie's triumphant last words at the microphone, articulated with confidence and a smile, were, "Ursprache, U-R-S-P-R-A-C-H-E, Ursprache." "I'm studying as hard as I can for my last year, to go for it," Carrie told a journalist who'd been tracking her preparations. "I'm trying to learn words off the regular list, to learn more obscure words that have a chance of coming up." The year before, the same journalist made the observation that Carrie does more word study by herself. She works with numerous spelling study guides, makes lists of interesting words from her reading, and labors her way through the dictionary. When we analyzed our data, we first confirmed what I'd found the year before. Grittier spellers practiced more than less gritty spellers. But the most important finding was that the type of practice mattered tremendously. Deliberate practice predicted advancing to further rounds in final competition far better than any other kind of preparation. When I share these findings with parents and students, I hasten to add that there are many, many learning benefits to being quizzed. Shining a light on what you think you know, but actually haven't yet mastered, is one. Indeed, winner Carrie Close later told me that she used quizzing to diagnose her weaknesses, to identify certain words or types of words she consistently misspelled, so that she could focus her efforts on mastering them. In a sense, quizzing may have been a necessary prelude to doing more targeted, more efficient, deliberate practice. What about reading for fun? Nada. Pretty much all of the kids in the National Spelling Bee are interested in language, but there wasn't even a hint of a relationship between reading for fun, which they all enjoyed, and spelling prowess. If you judge practice by how much it improves your skill, then deliberate practice has no rival. This lesson seemed to become increasingly clear to spellers as they spent more time competing. With each successive year of experience, they spent more time practicing deliberately. The same trend was even more pronounced in the month before the actual finals, when the average speller was devoting 10 hours per week to deliberate practice. If, however, you judge practice by what it feels like, you might come to a different conclusion. On average, spellers rated deliberate practice as significantly more effortful and significantly less enjoyable than anything else they did to prepare for competition. In contrast, spellers experienced reading books for pleasure and playing word games like Scrabble as effortless and as enjoyable as eating their favorite food. A vivid, if somewhat melodramatic, first-hand description of what deliberate practice can feel like comes from dancer Martha Graham. "Dancing appears glamorous, easy, delightful, but the path to the paradise of that achievement is not easier than any other. There is fatigue so great that the body cries even in its sleep. There are times of complete frustration. There are daily small deaths." Not everyone would describe working outside their comfort zone in such extreme terms, but Ericsson generally finds that deliberate practice is experienced as supremely effortful. As evidence that working at the far edge of our skills with complete concentration is exhausting, he points out that even world-class performers at the peak of their careers can only handle a maximum of 1 hour of deliberate practice before needing a break, and in total can only do about 3 to 5 hours of deliberate practice per day. It's also relevant that many athletes and musicians take naps after their most intensive training sessions. Why? Rest and recovery may seem an obvious necessity for athletes, but non-athletes say much the same about their most intense exertions, suggesting that it is the mental work, as much as the physical stresses, that makes deliberate practice so strenuous. For instance, Here's how director Judd Apatow describes making a film. Every day is an experiment. Every scene might not work, and so you're concentrating. Is it working? Should I get an extra line for editing? What would I change if I had to? If I hated this in 3 months, why would I hate it? And you're concentrating, and you're exhausted. It's pretty intense. And finally, world-class performers who retire tend not to keep up nearly the same deliberate practice schedule. If practice was intrinsically pleasurable, enjoyable for its own sake, you'd expect them to keep doing it. The year after Erickson and I began working together, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi spent his summer at my university as a scholar in residence. Csikszentmihalyi is as eminent a psychologist as Erickson, and both have devoted their careers to studying experts. But their accounts of world-class expertise couldn't be more different. For Csikszentmihalyi, the signature experience of experts is flow, a state of complete concentration that leads to a feeling of spontaneity. Flow is performing at high levels of challenge and yet feeling effortless, like you don't have to think about it, you're just doing it. For example, an orchestra conductor told Csikszentmihalyi, "You are in an ecstatic state to such a point that you feel as though you almost don't exist. My hand seems devoid of myself, and I have nothing to do with what's happening. I just sit there, watching in a state of awe and wonderment, and the music just flows out by itself." And a competitive figure skater gave this description of the flow state. "It was just one of those programs that clicked. I mean, everything went right. Everything felt good. It's just such a rush, like you could feel it could go on and on, like you don't want it to stop because it's going so well. It's almost as though you don't have to think. Everything goes automatically without thinking." Csikszentmihalyi has gathered similar first-person reports from hundreds of experts. In every field studied, optimal experience is described in similar terms. Erickson is skeptical that deliberate practice could ever feel as enjoyable as flow. In his view, skilled people can sometimes experience highly enjoyable states, like flow, during their performance. These states are, however, incompatible with deliberate practice. Why? Because deliberate practice is carefully planned, and flow is spontaneous. Because deliberate practice requires working where challenges exceed skill, and flow is most commonly experienced when challenge and skill are in balance. And most important, because deliberate practice is exceptionally effortful, and flow is, by definition, effortless. Csikszentmihalyi has published a contrary opinion. Quote, "Researchers who study the development of talents have concluded that to learn any complex skill well takes about 10,000 hours of practice, and the practice can be very boring and unpleasant. While this state of affairs is all too often true, the consequences are by no means self-evident." Unquote. Csikszentmihalyi goes on to share a personal story that helps explain his perspective. In Hungary, where he grew up, on the tall wooden gate at the entrance to the local elementary school hung a sign that read, "The roots of knowledge are bitter, but its fruits are sweet." This always struck him as deeply untrue. "Even when the learning is hard," he writes, "it is not bitter when you feel that it is worth having, that you can master it, that practicing what you learned will express who you are and help you achieve what you desire." So, who's right? As fate would have it, the same summer Csikszentmihalyi was visiting, Erickson was also in town. I arranged for them to debate the topic of passion and world-class performance before an audience of about 80 educators. When they sat down at the table in the front of the lecture hall, I realized that the two men are near-perfect doppelgangers. Both are tall and solidly built. Both are European by birth, with slight accents that somehow make them seem even more eminent and scholarly. Both sport close-cropped beards, and though only Csikszentmihalyi's has gone all white, Either man would be a good choice if you are looking for someone to play Santa Claus. On the day of the panel, I was a little anxious. I don't like conflict, even when it's not mine. It turns out I had nothing to worry about. The proponents of deliberate practice versus flow behaved as perfect gentlemen. No insults were exchanged. There wasn't even a hint of disrespect. Instead, Erickson and Csikszentmihalyi sat shoulder to shoulder, each taking the microphone when it was their turn, each methodically summarizing decades of research, summarizing starkly contrasting perspectives. When one was speaking, the other appeared to listen intently, and then the microphone would change hands. So it went for 90 minutes. Do experts suffer, I wanted to know, or are they ecstatic? Somehow, the dialogue I hoped would resolve this conundrum played out as two separate presentations, one on deliberate practice and the other on flow, spliced together. When it was all over, I found myself a little disappointed. It wasn't the drama that I missed, it was the resolution. I still didn't have an answer to my question. Is expert performance a matter of arduous and not-so-fun-in-the-moment exertion? Or can it be effortless and joyous? For years after that anticlimactic summit, I read and thought about the issue. Finally, because I never developed the conviction that might prompt me to reject one side and take the other, I decided to collect some data. I asked thousands of adults who'd taken the Grit Scale online to take a second questionnaire assessing flow. The participants in this study included men and women of all ages, representing all manner of professions. Actors, bakers, bank tellers, barbers, dentists, doctors, police officers, secretaries, teachers, waiters, and welders, to name just a few. Across these diverse occupations, grittier adults reported experiencing more flow, not less. In other words, flow and grit go hand in hand. Putting together what I learned from this survey, the findings on National Spelling Bee finalists, and a decade-long inspection of the relevant research literature, I've come to this conclusion. Gritty people do more deliberate practice and experience more flow. There's no contradiction here for two reasons. First, deliberate practice is a behavior, and flow is an experience. Anders Ericsson is talking about what experts do. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi is talking about how experts feel. Second, you don't have to be doing deliberate practice and experiencing flow at the same time. And in fact, I think that for most experts, they rarely go together. More research is needed to settle the question, and in the next few years, I'm hoping that Erickson, Csikszentmihalyi, and I can collaborate to do exactly that. Currently, my view is that the primary motivation for doing effortful, deliberate practice is to improve your skill. You're concentrating 100%, and you've deliberately set the level of challenge to exceed your current level of skill. You're in problem-solving mode, analyzing everything you do to bring it closer to the ideal, the goal you set at the beginning of the practice session. You're getting feedback, and a lot of that feedback is about what you're doing wrong, and you're using that feedback to make adjustments and try again. The motivation that predominates during flow, in contrast, is entirely different. The flow state is intrinsically pleasurable. You don't care whether you're improving some narrow aspect of your skill set. And though you're concentrating 100%, you're not at all in problem-solving mode. You're not analyzing what you're doing. You're just doing. You're getting feedback, but because the level of challenge just meets your current level of skill, that feedback is telling you that you're doing a lot right. You feel like you're in complete control because you are. You're floating. You lose track of time. No matter how fast you're running or how intensely you're thinking, when you're in flow, everything feels effortless. In other words, deliberate practice is for preparation, and flow is for performance. Let's return to swimmer Rowdy Gaines. Gaines told me he once tabulated how much practice it took to develop the stamina, technique, confidence, and judgment to win an Olympic gold medal. In the 8-year period leading up to the 1984 games, he swam in increments of 50-yard laps, at least 20,000 miles. Of course, if you add in the years before and after, the odometer goes even higher. "I swam around the world," he told me with a soft laugh, "for a race that lasted 49 seconds. "Did you enjoy those miles?" I asked. "I mean, did you love practicing?" "I'm not going to lie," he replied. "I never really enjoyed going to practice, and I certainly didn't enjoy it while I was there. In fact, there were brief moments, walking to the pool at 4 or 4:30 in the morning, or sometimes when I couldn't take the pain, when I'd think, 'God, is this worth it?'" "So why didn't you quit?" "It's very simple," Rowdy said. "It's because I loved swimming. I had a passion for competing, for the result of training, for the feeling of being in shape, for winning, for traveling, for meeting friends. I hated practice, but I had an overall passion for swimming." Olympic gold medalist rower Mads Rasmussen offered a similar account of his motivation. "It's about hard work. When it's not fun, you do what you need to do anyway. Because when you achieve results, it's incredibly fun. You get to enjoy the aha at the end, and that is what drags you along a lot of the way." The idea of years of challenge-exceeding skill practice leading to moments of challenge-meeting skill flow explains why elite performance can look so effortless. In a sense, it is. Here's an example. 18-year-old swimmer Katie Ledecky recently broke her own world record in the 1500-meter freestyle. Improbably, history was made during a preliminary round at a competition in Kazan, Russia. "To be honest, it felt pretty easy," she said afterward. "I was so relaxed." But it's not flow to which Ledecky credits her speed. "Breaking that record is testament to the work I have put in and the shape I am in right now." Indeed, Ledecky has been swimming since she was 6. She's developed a reputation for working fiercely hard at every single practice, sometimes training with male swimmers for added challenge. 3 years ago, Ledecky described blanking out a little bit in the race that won her the gold medal in the 800-meter freestyle. "One thing in terms of swimming that people don't really know," she later said, "is that the work you put in during practice shows off in the meet." Here's my own story of hours of effortful, deliberate practice leading to moments of effortless flow. A few years ago, a producer named Juliette Blake called to ask if I'd be interested in giving a 6-minute TED Talk. "Sure," I said, "sounds fun." "Wonderful. After you have your talk ready, we'll have a video conference where we watch you give it, and we'll give you some feedback. You know, something like a rehearsal." Feedback, you say? I thought. Something other than applause? More slowly, I said, "Sure, that sounds fine." I prepared a talk and on the appointed day connected with Juliette and her boss, the leader of TED, Chris Anderson. Staring into the webcam, I delivered my talk in the allotted time. Then I waited for my effusive praise. If there was any, I missed it. Instead, what I got was Chris telling me he'd gotten lost in all my scientific jargon. Too many syllables, too many slides, and not enough clear, understandable examples. Further, how I'd come to this whole line of research, my road from teacher to psychologist, was unclear and unsatisfying. Juliette agreed. She added that I'd managed to tell a story with absolutely zero suspense. The way I'd designed my talk was like telling the punchline of a joke at the very beginning. Ouch. That bad, huh? Juliette and Chris are busy people, and I knew I wouldn't get a second chance at getting coached, so I forced myself to listen. Afterward, I pondered who knew better how to give a great talk on grit, them or me. It didn't take long to realize that they were the experienced storytellers, and I was the scientist who needed feedback to make her talk better. So I rewrote the talk, practiced in front of my family, and got more negative feedback. "Why do you say all the time?" my older daughter Amanda asked. "Yeah, why do you do that, Mom?" my younger daughter Lucy chimed in. "And you bite your lip when you're nervous. Don't do that. It's distracting." More practice. More refinements. Then the fateful day arrived. I gave a talk that bore only a weak resemblance to the one I'd originally proposed. It was better. A lot better. Watch that talk and you'll see me in flow. Search YouTube for the many rehearsals that preceded it, or, for that matter, footage of anyone doing effortful, mistake-ridden, repetitive, deliberate practice, and my guess is you'll come up empty. Nobody wants to show you the hours and hours of becoming. They'd rather show the highlight of what they've become. After it was all over, I rushed to meet my husband and mother-in-law, who'd been in the audience that day to cheer me on. As soon as they were within earshot, I called out preemptively, "Just the effusive praise, please," and they delivered. Lately, I've been asking gritty performers and their coaches in diverse fields to elaborate on how it feels to do deliberate practice. Many agree with dancer Martha Graham that attempting to do what you cannot yet do is frustrating, uncomfortable, and even painful. However, some have suggested that, in fact, the experience of deliberate practice can be extremely positive, not just in the long term, but in the moment. Fun isn't quite the word they use to describe deliberate practice, but neither is bitter. And, too, top performers point out that the alternative to deliberate practice, mindlessly going through the motions without improvement, can be its own form of suffering. I puzzled over these observations for a while, and then I decided to look back at the diary data that Erickson and I had collected from the National Spelling Bee finalists. While I knew that spellers rated deliberate practice as especially effortful and unenjoyable, I also recalled that there was quite a spread around these averages. In other words, not all spellers had the same exact experience. I looked to see how grittier competitors experienced deliberate practice. Compared to their less passionate, less persevering competitors, grittier spellers not only logged more hours of deliberate practice, they rated it as both more enjoyable and more effortful. That's right, grittier kids reported working harder than other kids when doing deliberate practice, but at the same time said they enjoyed it more than other kids too. It's hard to know for sure what to make of this finding. One possibility is that grittier kids spend more time doing deliberate practice, and that over the years, they develop a taste for hard work as they experience the rewards of their labor. This is the learn-to-love-the-burn story. Alternatively, it could be that grittier kids enjoy the hard work more, and that gets them to do more of it. This is the some-people-enjoy-a-challenge story. I can't tell you which of these accounts is accurate, and if I had to guess, I'd say there's some truth to both. As we'll learn in Chapter 11, there's solid scientific evidence that the subjective experience of effort, what it feels like to work hard, can and does change when, for example, effort is rewarded in some way. I've watched my own daughters learn to enjoy working hard more than they used to, and I can say the same for myself. On the other hand, Katie Ledecky's coach, Bruce Gemmel, says she's always relished a tough challenge. "There's a little video clip that Katie's parents have of one of her first swim meets," Bruce told me. "It's just one lap. She's 6 years old. She swims a few strokes and then grabs onto the lane line. She swims a few more strokes and grabs onto the lane line again. Finally, she gets to the end of the pool and gets out of the water. Dad's filming it, and he asks, 'Tell me about your first race. How was it?' She goes, 'Great.' A few seconds later, she adds, 'That was hard.' And she's beaming, a smile from ear to ear. That says it all right there. She has that attitude with everything we do." In the same conversation, Bruce told me that Katie willingly does more deliberate practice than anyone he's ever met. We'll try a drill that she's horrible at, something where she'll start off in the poorest third of the group doing it. Then I'll catch her sneaking practice time to get better at it, so within some period of time, she's one of the best in the group. Some other swimmers, well, they try and they fail at it, and I have to cajole and beg them to try it again. If deliberate practice can be awesome, can it ever feel like effortless flow? When I asked spelling champ Kerry Close if she'd ever experienced the state of flow during deliberate practice, she said, "No, the only time I could say that I was in flow was when I wasn't being challenged." At the same time, she described deliberate practice as gratifying in its own way. "Some of my most rewarding studying," she told me, "was on my own, forcing myself to break down a big task into multiple parts and getting it done." As of now, there isn't enough research to say whether deliberate practice can be experienced as effortless flow. My guess is that deliberate practice can be deeply gratifying, but in a different way than flow. In other words, there are different kinds of positive experience. The thrill of getting better is one, and the ecstasy of performing at your best is another. Other than by getting yourself a terrific coach, mentor, or teacher, how can you get the most out of deliberate practice? And because you've earned it, experience more flow. First, know the science. Each of the basic requirements of deliberate practice is unremarkable. A clearly defined stretch goal, full concentration and effort, immediate and informative feedback. Finally, repetition with reflection and refinement. But how many hours of practice do most people accomplish that checks all four of these boxes? My guess is that many people are cruising through life doing precisely 0 hours of daily deliberate practice. Even super motivated people who are working to exhaustion may not be doing deliberate practice. For instance, when a Japanese rowing team invited Olympic gold medalist Mads Rasmussen to come visit, he was shocked at how many hours of practice their athletes were logging. "It's not hours of brute force exhaustion you're after," he told them. "It's high-quality, thoughtful training goals pursued just as Erickson's research has shown, for just a few hours a day, tops." Noah Kageyama, a performance psychologist on the faculty of the Juilliard School of Music, says he's been playing the violin since he was 2, but didn't really start practicing deliberately until he was 22. Why not? There was no lack of motivation. At one point, young Noah was taking lessons with 4 different teachers and literally commuting to 3 different cities to work with them all. Really, the problem was just that Noah didn't know better. Once he discovered there was an actual science of practice, an approach that would improve his skills more efficiently, both the quality of his practice and his satisfaction with his progress skyrocketed. He's now devoted himself to sharing that knowledge with other musicians. A few years ago, my graduate student Lauren Esquis Winkler and I decided to teach kids about deliberate practice. We put together self-guided lessons, complete with cartoons and stories illustrating key differences between deliberate practice and less effective ways of studying. We explained that no matter their initial talent, great performers in every domain improve through deliberate practice. We let students know that hidden behind every effortless performance on YouTube are hours and hours of unrecorded, invisible to outsiders, challenging, effortful, mistake-ridden practice. We told them that trying to do things they can't yet do, failing, and learning what they need to do differently is exactly the way experts practice. We help them understand that feelings of frustration aren't necessarily a sign they're on the wrong track. On the contrary, we told them that wishing they did things better is extremely common during learning. We then tested this intervention against different kinds of placebo control activities. What we found is that students can change the way they think about practice and achievement. For instance, asked what advice they'd give to another student on how to succeed in school, students who learned about deliberate practice were more likely to recommend focus on your weaknesses and concentrate 100%. Given the choice between doing deliberate practice in math versus entertaining themselves with social media and gaming websites, they elected to do more deliberate practice. And finally, in the case of those who'd been performing at a below-average level in class, learning about deliberate practice increased their report card grades. Which leads to my second suggestion for getting the most out of deliberate practice. Make it a habit. By this I mean, figure out when and where you're most comfortable doing deliberate practice. Once you've made your selection, do deliberate practice then and there every day. Why? Because routines are a godsend when it comes to doing something hard. A mountain of research studies, including a few of my own, show that when you have a habit of practicing at the same time and in the same place every day, you hardly have to think about getting started. You just do. The book Daily Rituals by Mason Curry describes a day in the life of 161 artists, scientists, and other creators. If you look for a particular rule like always drink coffee, or never drink coffee, or only work in your bedroom, or never work in your bedroom, you won't find it. But if instead you ask, what do these creators have in common, you'll find the answer right in the title, Daily Rituals. In their own particular way, all the experts in this book consistently put in hours and hours of solitary deliberate practice. They follow routines. They're creatures of habit. For instance, cartoonist Charles Schulz, who drew almost 18,000 Peanuts comic strips in his career, rose at dawn, showered, shaved, and had breakfast with his children. He then drove his kids to school and went to his studio, where he worked through lunch, a ham sandwich and a glass of milk, until his children returned from school. Writer Maya Angelou's routine was to get up and have coffee with her husband, and then, by 7 in the morning, deliver herself to a tiny, mean hotel room with no distractions until 2 in the afternoon. Eventually, if you keep practicing at the same time and place, what once took conscious thought to initiate becomes automatic. There is no more miserable human being, observed William James, than the one for whom the beginning of every bit of work must be decided anew each day. I myself learned that lesson quickly. I now know what Joyce Carol Oates meant when she likened completing the first draft of a book to pushing a peanut across a very dirty kitchen floor with your nose. So, what did I do? Here's the simple daily plan that helped me get going. When it's 8 in the morning and I'm in my home office, I will reread yesterday's draft. This habit didn't make the writing easier, per se, but it sure made it easier to get started. My third suggestion for getting the most out of deliberate practice is to change the way you experience it. Around the time I was revisiting my National Spelling Bee data and discovering how much more enjoyable the experience of deliberate practice is for grittier competitors, I called up a swimming coach named Terry Lachlan. Terry has coached every level of swimmer, from complete newbie to Olympic champion, and broken records himself in open water master swimming. I was particularly interested in his perspective because he's long advocated what he calls a total immersion approach to swimming, essentially a relaxed, mindful approach to gliding through the water. Deliberate practice can feel wonderful, Terry told me. If you try, you can learn to embrace challenge rather than fear it. You can do all the things you're supposed to do during deliberate practice, a clear goal, feedback, all of it, and still feel great while you're doing it. It's all about in-the-moment self-awareness without judgment, he continued. It's about relieving yourself of the judgment that gets in the way of enjoying the challenge. After hanging up with Terry, I began to think about the fact that infants and toddlers spend most of their time trying to do things they can't, again and again, And yet, they don't seem especially embarrassed or anxious. No pain, no gain is a rule that doesn't seem to apply to the preschool set. Elena Bodrova and Deborah Lung, psychologists who've devoted their careers to studying how children learn, agree that learning from mistakes is something babies and toddlers don't mind at all. Watch a baby struggle to sit up or a toddler learn to walk. You'll see one error after another, failure after failure, a lot of challenge exceeding skill, a lot of concentration, a lot of feedback, a lot of learning. Emotionally? Well, they're too young to ask, but very young children don't seem tortured while they're trying to do things they can't yet do. And then something changes. According to Elena and Deborah, around the time children enter kindergarten, they begin to notice that their mistakes inspire certain reactions in grown-ups. What do? We frown. Our cheeks flush a bit. We rush over to our little ones to point out that they've done something wrong. And what's the lesson we're teaching? Embarrassment. Fear. Shame. Coach Bruce Gemmel says that's exactly what happens to many of his swimmers. Between coaches and parents and friends and the media, he told me, they've learned that failing is bad, so they protect themselves and won't stick their neck out and give their best effort. Shame doesn't help you fix anything, Deborah told me. So, what's to be done? Elena and Deborah asked teachers to model emotion-free mistake-making. They actually instruct teachers to commit an error on purpose and then let students see them say, with a smile, "Oh gosh, I thought there were 5 blocks in this pile. Let me count again. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There are 6 blocks. Great. I learned I need to touch each block as I count." Whether you can make deliberate practice as ecstatic as flow, I don't know. But I do think you can try saying to yourself and to others, "That was hard. It was great." Chapter 8. Purpose. Interest is one source of passion. Purpose, the intention to contribute to the well-being of others, is another. The mature passions of gritty people depend on both. For some, purpose comes first. This is the only way I can understand a paragon of grit like Alex Scott. Ever since Alex could remember, she'd been sick. Her neuroblastoma had been diagnosed when she was a year old. Shortly after her 4th birthday, Alex told her mother, "When I get out of the hospital, I want to have a lemonade stand." And she did. She operated her first lemonade stand before she turned 5, raising $2,000 for her doctors to help other kids like they helped her. When Alex passed away 4 years later, she'd inspired so many people to create their own lemonade stands that she'd raised more than $1 million. Alex's family has continued her legacy, and to date, Alex's Lemonade Stand Foundation has raised more than $100 million for cancer research. Alex was extraordinary. But most people first become attracted to things they enjoy, and only later appreciate how these personal interests might also benefit others. In other words, the more common sequence is to start out with a relatively self-oriented interest, then learn self-discipline practice, and finally integrate that work with an other-centered purpose. The psychologist Benjamin Bloom was among the first to notice this 3-phase progression. 30 years ago, when Bloom set out to interview world-class athletes, artists, mathematicians, and scientists, he knew he'd learn something about how people reach the top of their fields. What he didn't foresee was that he'd discover a general model of learning that applied to all the fields he studied. Despite superficial differences in their upbringing and training, all the extraordinary people in Bloom's study had progressed through 3 distinct periods of development. We discussed what Bloom called the early years in Chapter 6 on interest, and the middle years in Chapter 7 on practice. We've now come to the third, final, and longest phase in Bloom's model, the later years, when, as he put it, the larger purpose and meaning of work finally becomes apparent. When I talk to grit paragons, and they tell me that what they're pursuing has purpose, they mean something much deeper than mere intention. They're not just goal-oriented. The nature of their goals is special. When I probe, asking, "Can you tell me more? What do you mean?" there sometimes follows an earnest, stumbling struggle to put how they feel into words. But always, always, those next sentences mention other people. Sometimes it's very particular. My children, my clients, my students. And sometimes quite abstract. This country, the sport, science, society. However they say it, the message is the same. The long days and evenings of toil, the setbacks and disappointments and struggle, the sacrifice, all this is worth it because ultimately their efforts pay dividends to other people. At its core, the idea of purpose is the idea that what we do matters to people other than ourselves. A precocious altruist like Alex Scott is an easy-to-fathom example of other-centered purpose. So is art activist Jane Golden, the grit paragon we met in Chapter 6. Interest in art led Jane to become a muralist in Los Angeles after graduating from college. In her late 20s, Jane was diagnosed with lupus and told she didn't have long to live. "The news came as such a shock," she told me. "It gave me a new perspective on life." When Jane recovered from the disease's most acute symptoms, she realized she would outlive the doctor's initial predictions, but with chronic pain. Moving back to her hometown of Philadelphia, she took over a small anti-graffiti program in the mayor's office, and over the next 3 decades, grew it into one of the largest public art programs in the world. Now in her late 50s, Jane continues to work from early morning to late in the evening, 6 or 7 days a week. One colleague likens working with her to running a campaign office the night before an election, except election day never comes. For Jane, those hours translate into more murals and programs, and that means more opportunities for people in the community to create and experience art. When I asked Jane about her lupus, she admitted, matter-of-factly, that pain is a constant companion. She once told a journalist, "There are moments when I cry. I think I just can't do it anymore, push that boulder up the hill. But feeling sorry for myself is pointless, so I find ways to get energized." Why? Because her work is interesting? That's only the beginning of Jane's motivation. "Everything I do is in a spirit of service," she told me. "I feel driven by it. It's a moral imperative." Putting it more succinctly, she said, "Art saves lives." Other grit paragons have top-level goals that are purposeful in less obvious ways. Renowned wine critic Antonio Galloni, for instance, told me, "An appreciation for wine is something I'm passionate about sharing with other people. When I walk into a restaurant, I want to see a beautiful bottle of wine on every table." Antonio says his mission is to help people understand their own palates. When that happens, he says, it's like a light bulb goes off, and he wants to make a million light bulbs go off. So while interest for Antonio came first, his parents owned a food and wine shop while he was growing up, and he was always fascinated by wine, even at a young age, his passion is very much enhanced by the idea of helping other people. "I'm not a brain surgeon," he told me. "I'm not curing cancer, but in this one small way, I think I'm going to make the world better. I wake up every morning with a sense of purpose." In my grit lexicon, therefore, purpose means the intention to contribute to the well-being of others. After hearing repeatedly from grit paragons how deeply connected they felt their work was to other people, I decided to analyze that connection more closely. Sure, purpose might matter, but how much does it matter relative to other priorities? It seemed possible that single-minded focus on a top-level goal is, in fact, typically more selfish than selfless. Aristotle was among the first to recognize that there are at least two ways to pursue happiness. He called one eudaimonic, in harmony with one's good inner spirit, and the other hedonic, aimed at positive, in-the-moment, inherently self-centered experiences. Aristotle clearly took a side on the issue, deeming the hedonic life primitive and vulgar, and upholding the eudaimonic life as noble and pure. But in fact, both of these approaches to happiness have very deep evolutionary roots. On one hand, human beings seek pleasure because, by and large, the things that bring us pleasure are those that increase our chances of survival. If our ancestors hadn't craved food and sex, for example, they wouldn't have lived very long or had many offspring. To some extent, all of us are, as Freud put it, driven by the pleasure principle. On the other hand, human beings have evolved to seek meaning and purpose. In the most profound way, we're social creatures. Why? Because the drive to connect with and serve others also promotes survival. How so? Because people who cooperate are more likely to survive than loners. Society depends on stable interpersonal relationships, and society in so many ways keeps us fed, shelters us from the elements, and protects us from enemies. The desire to connect is as basic a human need as our appetite for pleasure. To some extent, we're all hardwired to pursue both hedonic and eudaimonic happiness, but the relative weight we give these two kinds of pursuits can vary. Some of us care about purpose much more than we care about pleasure, and vice versa. To probe the motivations that underlie grit, I recruited 16,000 American adults and asked them to complete the grit scale. As part of a long supplementary questionnaire, study participants read statements about purpose. For instance, what I do matters to society, and indicated the extent to which each applied to them. They did the same for six statements about the importance of pleasure. For instance, for me, the good life is the pleasurable life. From these responses, we generated scores ranging from 1 to 5 for their orientations to purpose and pleasure, respectively. On the PDF included with this audiobook, I've plotted the data from this large-scale study, and we will go through it now. The data show that gritty people aren't monks, nor are they hedonists. In terms of pleasure-seeking, they're just like anyone else. Pleasure is moderately important no matter how gritty you are. In sharp contrast, you can see that grittier people are dramatically more motivated than others to seek a meaningful, other-centered life. Higher scores on purpose correlate with higher scores on the grit scale. This is not to say that all grit paragons are saints, but rather that most gritty people see their ultimate aims as deeply connected to the world beyond themselves. My claim here is that for most people, purpose is a tremendously powerful source of motivation. There may be exceptions, but the rarity of these exceptions proves the rule. What am I missing? Well, it's unlikely that my sample included many terrorists or serial killers, and it's true that I haven't interviewed political despots or mafia bosses. I guess you could argue that I'm overlooking a whole population of grit paragons whose goals are purely selfish, or worse, directed at harming others. On this point, I concede, partly. In theory, you can be a misanthropic, misguided paragon of grit. Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler, for instance, were most certainly gritty. They also prove that the idea of purpose can be perverted. How many millions of innocent people have perished at the hands of demagogues whose stated intention was to contribute to the well-being of others? In other words, a genuinely positive, altruistic purpose is not an absolute requirement of grit. And I have to admit that yes, it is possible to be a gritty villain. But on the whole, I take the survey data I've gathered and what paragons of grit tell me in person at face value. So, while interest is crucial to sustaining passion,